Dear listener, we hope that you've been enjoying the variety of podcasts that we have on our network. Now is your opportunity to help us by telling us a little more about you. Please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey and complete our listener survey so that we can learn more about you and your listening habits. Again, please visit jcastnetwork.org/survey. Thanks so much.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finn, and we have got a great show for you today. We open up with a little bit of Shlomo Karabach. It was Reb Shlomo's Yahrzeit this week. Lots of people went to visit his grave in Israel. In this half hour of the show, we will be interviewing the editors of the newly released Comprehensive English-Yiddish Dictionary. That would be Gittel Schachter Vishvanov and Paul Glasser. They're going to be on here. We have lots of wonderful Jewish music. We have a very nice tribute to Leonard Cohen in Yiddish, one of his songs, as they say, Übersetzt. The portion of the week is the portion of Chayesorah, which can be found in chapter 17 of the book of Genesis, a wonderful Hasidic story at the end. Stay tuned all the way till then. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Ahmed Khan Rahami, the suspect behind the bombings that wounded 31 people in New York in September, pleaded not guilty to terrorism-related charges in Manhattan federal court. Rahami is charged with setting bombs in Manhattan and New Jersey. According to the FBI, a rise in hate crimes against Muslims and Jews contributed to a 6.8% increase in 2015 of incidents from the previous year. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declined an invitation to meet with President-elect Donald Trump before his inauguration. In a phone conversation between the two, Trump suggested that Netanyahu come as soon as possible to meet with him. After discussing the appropriate protocols of such a visit, Netanyahu, quote, elegantly, I like that adjective or adverb, elegantly refused Trump's invitation in order to avoid embarrassing Obama. Israel's civil administration officials raided a charcoal factory in Jenin and seized 160 tons of tree prunings. Jenin is listed as having the worst pollution in Israel and the highest rate of respiratory problems in the country, and much of it is because of illegally run kilns. And finally, a laser-equipped drone made in Israel was the highlight of the Homeland Security show. The drone is capable of finding bombs and drugs from a quarter mile away, and no one gets hurt. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in a growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have the editor of the Comprehensive English-Yiddish Dictionary, Ms. Gittel Schachter Vishvanat, on the air right now for you, for your listening pleasure. How are you today, Gittel?
I'm very fine. Thank you.
Good to hear. Good to hear. Okay, so I have in my possession this wonderful tome of lots of English words. It's about 85,000 English words translated into Yiddish and to this wonderful compendium. Now, for the first question I have is, why do we need an English-Yiddish dictionary, Gittel?
Okay, well, this is the first English-Yiddish dictionary to be published since 1968, so we're talking almost 50 years. That dictionary was Uriel Weinrath's Modern English-Yiddish, Yiddish-English Dictionary, and it was amazing when it came out. But it is almost 50 years later, and first of all, there were thousands of words that were not included in that dictionary, and there are also thousands of words that have come up since then. And I just want the listeners to understand that this project came from my father, who was Dr. Mordechai Schachter. He was a Yiddish linguist and lexicographer and a Yiddish professor at Columbia University. And it was his life goal to publish all the words, maybe not all, but as many words as possible that, for one reason or another, never made it into previous dictionaries, including terminology for science, for math, for music, for art. All these, the terminological professional terminologies, jargon, you might want to call them, but they're not jargon. They're really, like legalese and et cetera. And include them in a dictionary so that anyone wanting access to these words would know where to find them. These words were not coined by myself or by Paul or by my father. They were found in the literature, in publications, in conversations with people who had been born in Eastern Europe. The research for this project continued for approximately 50 years. Before we actually started working on it. And so that's the history behind it. The question that you asked, why, is because we still have people today who are speaking Yiddish. We still have people who are learning Yiddish and wanting to learn Yiddish. And in a sense, you can ask which comes first, the chicken or the egg. If somebody's taking a Yiddish course and has access to dictionaries that just doesn't give them all the words that they need, they could be frustrated and just decide, oh, you know what, I'm going to study French, or I'll study Hebrew or Russian. But once you have the dictionary that has so many words and expressions, not just words, but also expressions, idioms, and so forth, it facilitates the learning of a language. And this was our goal. This was my father's goal. It's my goal. And here we have it, 83,000 words and expressions.
Okay. So there were previous editions of English-Yiddish dictionaries. Weinreich did one. I think Harkavai also did one.
Yes.
How much of those dictionaries were like straight incorporated into your compendium of comprehensive English-Yiddish dictionaries? So in other words, how many new words would you say weren't in previous dictionaries, Gittel?
So that's sort of a tough question because, first of all, and I should just say, this is a very serious dictionary. The attention that's being paid to it is because it has new coinages, which is also wonderful, but it is a very serious dictionary. And Paul and I, for the most part, did not coin many new words, maybe a hundred, maybe even fewer. But when you think about it, every concept that comes into a language, we need to coin a, not we, every language needs to coin a word for that. So there were coinages in Weinrath's dictionary in 1968. There were coinages in Harkavy's dictionary of 1898. So in every dictionary that comes out, also the Oxford English Dictionary, there are always words being created. We did have to coin some words because of new concepts, but most of the coinages that people will see in this dictionary were created along the way, either by linguists or by grassroots acceptance of a term, which happens in all languages. We only coined words when we looked at other languages and simply could not find an appropriate equivalent for Yiddish.
Okay.
So and by the way, we also consulted with various dictionaries. We have a Russian Yiddish dictionary, which is an amazing treasure. We have a 900-page Yiddish thesaurus from 1950, which is another treasure. And we pored over these books as well to find anything that would help us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let's even go back a little bit further about what is Yiddish. Yiddish is, for the most part, sounds German. I heard lots of people saying, oh, I took German in high school, so I should be able to speak Yiddish, but that's really very far from the truth. And so could you tell us about the development of Yiddish? Because there are areas where Jews live, like, say, in Spain or Italy or in Iraq and Persia, where Jews don't speak Yiddish, but they speak their own vernacular. It's kind of like the same concept, but it's not Yiddish.
Correct. So Yiddish is more than 1,000 years old, and there are several theories about where it originated. The most common theory is that it arose in the area of the Rhine River, in the area where Germany and France sort of meet. And there were traders, Jewish, you know, businessmen. There was a lot of travel. There was trade. And Yiddish is a Germanic language, meaning that it originated from Middle High German. Middle High German is not the German that we know today. It was the German of 1,000 years ago. So the structure of the language is Germanic. And many words came in from Slavic languages, from French, from Romance languages, and very importantly, from Hebrew, from Lashon Kodesh. Of course, at that time, there was no modern Hebrew, but the words came in from Aramaic and Lashon Kodesh, which is translated as the Holy Language, but that's another word for the Hebraic and Aramaic elements in the Yiddish language. And so in the beginning, it really was sort of a combination of languages, and after time, it developed into its own, you know, standalone language. In 1908, there was a conference in Chernivtsi, Romania, where Yiddish was declared one of the Jewish languages. So, of course, Yiddish is the language of Eastern European Jewry. There are other pockets of Jews all over the world. Everybody came from the Babylonian exile. And we have the Jews of Spain and Portugal and other areas. They spoke Judeo-Spanish, otherwise known as Ladino or Judesmo. There are dozens probably of other Jewish languages. Some don't exist today. Some do still exist. But Yiddish and Ladino, I think, are the ones that are still heard to this day. Yiddish, obviously, much more than Ladino. And so that's pretty much how it developed.
Mm-hmm.
Jews have never had, well, for thousands of years, did not have a country. And so they developed their own languages within the communities that they lived in. And they had contact with the surrounding communities, obviously, and words and expressions were imported from other languages, and that's how we got these Judaic languages.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if you're just joining us, our guest today is Gitl Schachter Visvanath, and she is the editor of the Comprehensive English-Yiddish Dictionary. It just occurred to me, Gitl, Jews, whenever they were exiled, picked up a Judeo-whatever. The Talmud, for example, is written in Judeo-Aramaic. And from there, they moved on, and they got to, you know, the Ladino and the Yiddish and the Judeo-Arabic and Judeo-Italian. There is no mm-hmm. Judeo-English. Jews never did that.
No, but there are Jews who mix a lot of English into their language. I don't think anyone calls it Judeo-English. Well, there is an expression, Yinglish.
Yinglish, yes.
Which is sort of humorous, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's not a language. There are people who speak Yiddish, and we find them among the Hasidim, where Yiddish is a must for them, for certain Hasidic sects. There are other Hasidic sects that don't speak Yiddish at all, but for the most part, the ones in America speak Yiddish, and it's a must for daily life, but it's not perhaps a priority to keep the language pure in the sense of not mixing in words from other languages. So there is, we find a lot of English in the language of Hasidim. We're hoping that perhaps they'll use this dictionary and want to, you know, incorporate the words that they actually would know from their grandparents. But, you know, after the Holocaust, when a lot of the Hasidim came and settled here, so much was lost, including the people who spoke that language. And so it was recreated by importing English words, but most all of the English words that they use, and not just Hasidim, I shouldn't just, any Jew who imports English words into their language, they're importing English words or using English words because they don't have a source to look for that word. And that was the goal of this dictionary, that if you want to know how to say a specific tool that's used in the kitchen, for example, or in the garage, or, you know, a philosophical concept, those words exist in Yiddish, and they are in this dictionary.
Okay.
Of course, we don't have every word in the Yiddish language, but we tried our best to get as much as we could.
Indeed. I'm going to talk about that a little coming up soon. My mother, of blessed memory, spoke a wonderful Yiddish. She was born actually in Newark. Her parents were born in northern Poland, and they prided themselves on their diction and dialect in Yiddish, per se. My grandmother, I remember her like making fun of somebody no end because he said pitter instead of putter, you know, so that type of thing. My mother always took umbrage with the word, the Yiddish word for sweater. And you mentioned that you asked people from like Eastern Europe about coinages and usages. She really became, she just said that the word for sweater, how do you say sweater in Yiddish, Gittel?
Sweater.
Sweater, okay. She said baloney. She spent like, this was like her crusade. And she even, when I was living in Australia, she actually came down and said, aha, I knew it, because do you know how they say sweater in Yiddish in Australia? They say jumper, because in Australia, a sweater's not called a sweater. A sweater's called a jumper. So there, they called the sweater a jumper. So, and
right.
So I'm worried about the authenticity of coinages, and it's not just people being lazy or looking for another word. I remember when I was first learning Yiddish, because Yiddish is not my first language. I tell people, as the bubbe and the mamme, geret Yiddish, al sich not verstehen. So my grandmother and mother used to talk Yiddish, so I wouldn't understand, but I fooled them. I learned it. And so therefore, since I'm going into foreign mode, so I don't want to put an English word there. But I did hear two people talking once on a corner in Brooklyn, and one of them said, "Kannst du gehen zu store and kauf for me a pack of cigarettes, bitte?" You know, so could you go to the store and buy me a? You know, it's like I just looked at him and said, "That's not Yiddish. What are you doing?" So
right.
There is, I mean, Yiddish actually prides itself on this this ability of adaptation. Wherever it goes, people put in the words. And you know, if you lived in Germany, the thing they put on your head was a Hitlerin. But if you lived in Russia, it was a Schlappe. So are there really Yiddish words, per se, Gittel? And answer that question about sweater, if you don't mind.
What was the specific question about sweater?
Well, how do we really say sweater? If in Australia they call it jumper, which is not even a J in sound in Yiddish, you have to have three letters to make a J. So
that is correct. Yeah.
So tell us about like words like sweater and the authenticity of asking people, well, how did your grandmother say it, and then just hoping that they weren't saying some Russian word.
Right. So, first of all, about the Dalet Zayin Shin, the three letters that make the J sound, that does exist in Yiddish, and we have numerous words with that consonant cluster. For example, Nujin, and we know that in English, that came into English, you know, as a noun. Don't be a nudge, right? But the Yiddish word is Nujin or Nudjin. So J as a sound absolutely exists in Yiddish. And the question about sweater. So, and Jews lived in different communities, and so words entered their Yiddish from different language communities. So, for example, we have the word for the lid of a pot. Okay, the lid of a pot. And we have perhaps four or five different words. There's the one that the words in Russia, that the Jews in Russia used. There's the one that the Jews in Poland used. And we try to include in this dictionary several synonyms, the ones that were most widespread, either today or in the literature, because sometimes there were nine different synonyms, and somewhere you have to draw the line. So with sweater, there may have been a language community that said jumper, I have no doubt. But when we were researching it in all the dictionaries and all the people we knew and all the research that came from my father's collections indicated sweater. I'm sorry, sweater. And it's not just sweater, it's sweater with two vowels and a tess. So it's really, like in Yiddish, you don't say computer, you say computer, because you actually also pronounce it in the language that you're speaking. So we only have sweater in this dictionary. If jumper exists, I'm not an expert on all dialects. It probably exists. And if you speak to my co-editor-in-chief, Paul Glasser, he might actually know better than me. He's a PhD in linguistics, so he would know.
Okay, let's talk about this, the development of the dictionary per se. There are close to 85,000 words in this dictionary, and you're translating from English to Yiddish. The complete Oxford English Dictionary has over 400,000 words. So somehow you left out about 315,000 English words that didn't merit to get into the Comprehensive English Yiddish Dictionary. Can you explain why and how that developed?
What a goal. What a goal to get 400,000 words. So actually, I think the OED, I'm not sure that there is a dictionary in any other language that has that many words in it. But, you know, English is spoken all over the world.
I mean, that's true. You need a whole table for that dictionary. I mean, you know, so yes.
A table. You need, you know, 200 people working on that at least. And we have limited resources and limited funds. And again, you would need a whole table. We wanted a dictionary that people could actually lift. And I mean, that wasn't necessarily the main goal here, but this dictionary weighs 4.8 pounds. So it's not such a light tome. And we just, what we did is I went through a pocket English Hebrew dictionary. Actually, the Oxford Pocket English Hebrew Dictionary, because my father's collections were not, when I took over the project, he had become ill and he was still, you know, reviewing and editing. And so there was a lot of work that needed to be done and there were many words that were still missing. So I went through a pocket dictionary just to be sure that we included all the words that are at a minimum, in a good pocket dictionary. And I did not go through the OED. That would have taken three lifetimes. But we did what we could. And what we did was, I believe that the Weinrath Dictionary has approximately 20,000 words. So if we have 83,000 words, or words and expressions, I think that's, what is that, 400%?
Mm-hmm.
It is significantly larger and will have a huge impact in terms of being able to access words that people need when they want to speak the language.
Okay. Now, is it normal that when a new word develops in English, and you have people like me who are thinking, well, I want the Yiddish word for it, and I don't want to say just computer for computer. But I'm thinking like in Hebrew, for example, when computers came out, they call them machashbin, which comes from the word, the Hebrew root of the word to compute. So, but there are a lot of, I mean, just by the nature of Yiddish, there are a lot of just sort of like, we'll switch the accent from this first syllable to the last syllable, kind of raise our inflection of the middle, and then we'll make it a Yiddish word and call it computer.
Okay, so I don't want to give the wrong impression. I actually, you know, maybe I shouldn't have used computer as an example.
I was going to use that example, but, actually, yes.
Okay. Okay. So every language has loan borrowings, loan translations from other languages. And when it is a question of scientific terms or technology, especially, I guess, in the last 50 years, the last century, there are words that you'll find in every language. And as a matter of fact, for computer, Hebrew is one of the exceptions that the people who were creating modern Hebrew came up with a word for computer that's different. But if you look in many, many languages, the word for computer
is computer.
Computer pronounced as it would be in that language. That was the point that I was trying to make. Not that we should have just, you know, en masse import English words. But loan borrowings, they're very important when languages are coining the words. And we did that when there was a concept that came up or a new expression. We looked at other languages. We looked at Russian, we looked at German, we looked at Hebrew, we looked at French, and we looked to see how are other languages dealing with this. How could we use that kind of approach to coin a new word if we have to. So one of the concepts that you do is every language has its own collection of prefixes, suffixes, sentence structure. And I'll give you an example. So the word for a text message, we did not coin this. It was coined probably 10, 15 years ago. I don't know by whom, whenever texting started, I guess. So in Yiddish, as in most languages, the word for text, just written text, is text. Okay, mm-hmm. That's the word.
Right.
A text message is a few lines of text. So, however, the Yiddish word for text developed, it is textual. The word for text message in Yiddish is a textual, implying that it is a little bit of text, because in Yiddish, when you put a lamed at the end of a word, it makes it diminutive. So textual, in a way, was a very organic way of coining a word in Yiddish that sounds Yiddish. But it is, in fact, you know, it is based on an international word, so to speak, a text, but sort of absorbed into the Yiddish sentence structure. And to send a text message is textlin, which is, again, a Yiddish construct. So that's the approach that we try to take.
Okay, understand. Let's segue next to this next thing. There are words which are straight. Like, for example, a name of something which just gets spelled into Yiddish. Yiddish uses Hebrew characters. So everywhere right. that I've seen in different languages that I've looked in, the way that you say Facebook is Facebook. In Hebrew, you say Facebook. You know, so that makes it like Hebrew. Why does, if it's just the same word, it's because it is a name, I believe Facebook is capitalized, if I'm not mistaken. So
yes.
Why does that need to be in the dictionary? You can just know that you're going to call it Facebook anyway.
That's a good question. Because it's part of popular culture. And I can tell you that there are actually people, I have heard people jokingly refer to it as Punimbich, you know, meaning translating Facebook. But it's also important, if we're using a word in Yiddish, if a word has become part of the language, it's also important to know how to spell it in Yiddish. And Yiddish spelling, orthography, that's a whole other area that, different Jews might say, oh, but my grandmother spelled it differently, and, you know, she lived in such and such a place. Well, the YIVO, which is the Jewish Scientific Institute, which originated in Vilna and now is in New York, together with the secular Yiddish school system in Eastern Europe, created a standardized spelling system. And that is the spelling system that is taught in most Yiddish classes across the world. I can't say all because they may not include all of them. But that is the accepted standardized Yiddish spelling. So somebody else might spell Facebook Fe-Ayin-Yud-Samach, which would also be pronounced face. But the sound A in Yiddish, according to the standardized spelling, is spelled with two yuds, not Ayin-Yud. So I don't know if that's too descriptive or
that's
clear
fine.
for your listeners.
We're being word
so
geeks today anyway, yes.
We're doing what?
We're being word geeks today, yes.
Yes, absolutely. So it's also a question of spelling, as well as is it the dead or does? What is the article? In Yiddish, we have three different articles. There's the masculine, there's the feminine, and there's the neutral. So it's more than just transliterating a word in another language. It's indicating how we would use it and how we would write it.
Okay, fine. Fascinating, actually. So Hebrew is a very descriptive language, which is why it's so easy to take words out of their context, to get a word that doesn't that you don't see computer in Hebrew.
Right.
I didn't look this up, but maybe you could tell me and give you insight. The thing that goes when you're writing an email address, so in English, we call it at. It used to be the a piece sign. When I was growing up, it was like you got three of these at 29 cents a piece, and you had this little squiggle thing over there. In in Hebrew, it's called a strudel because
strudel.
Looks like
That's
a strudel. So what have we done with the at sign in Yiddish, Gittel?
It's actually in the dictionary. And I don't offhand remember, but I remember we had a whole conversation about the strudel. So hold on. I'm looking it up as we speak. And let me see. The at sign is either off, by, or strudel.
Could go either way, then.
It may sound like a funny word, but it's a serious word in Hebrew, and it entered the Yiddish language through, I don't know how, but it became part of the Yiddish language as well.
Yeah, it would make sense to say oif because that would be the English, the Yiddish way of saying at, but if you're going to do it from it. So then I guess it's like, how does the origin of this Yiddish word come, and which is going to be the primary influence? Is it going to be the English? Is it going to be the Hebrew? Is it going to be the German?
Right.
Et cetera. That's actually a very philosophical, existential question that we're dealing with.
Absolutely. And you should also, we all also need to realize that in languages that have a country, for example, French, they have an institute where words are discussed all day and coined. I forgot the name of the institute. Offhand. It's not the Alliance Française, but it has another name. Hebrew has the Sochnut, and other languages also have their institutes. So Yiddish had the Yivo. They're not doing that today, Yivo, but probably pre-war. The Yivo was doing that. What we have today is smaller groups, smaller collectives of experts in various fields. So in the 1980s, I'll give you one example, there was a computer terminology list, a computer terminology group, collegium, of people who were computer experts, and they wanted to know, they needed to know, how do we say this? I'm sorry, they were Yiddish speakers and computer experts, and they wanted to know, how do we say such and such in Yiddish? And they spent several years, I guess, on and off working on this, and suggestions were made and discussions were had, and it's actually possible that textbook came out of that. I'm not 100% sure, but you know, that's how words sort of come in. You know, there were maybe 10 suggestions for the word for email. How, in the end, we ended up with Blitzpost and Blitzbrief, I'm not sure, because I wasn't part of that group. But yet, the people who are using a Yiddish word for email are, for the most part, using Blitzbrief and Blitzpost. And do you understand the difference between Blitzbrief and Blitzpost?
I'm sorry, what?
The difference. So, you know, when we talk about email, there's the email system.
Yes.
And then there's the email letter.
Okay.
So the email system is called Blitzpost.
Okay.
Like lightning mail.
Mm-hmm.
A Blitzbrief is the actual email letter.
Gotcha.
Right.
Understood. Now, so we're running out of time, everybody. I do have a question about where Yiddish is going. About, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, maybe or so, I had on the show two college professors. These were young women who had written a book about Yiddish. It wasn't a Yiddish book. It was it was probably their doctoral thesis or something like that. And I was talking to them beforehand, and these are women who teach Yiddish in major universities around the country. Mm-hmm. And I started to speak with them in Yiddish. And one of them said, "We don't speak Yiddish. We read and translate from Yiddish to English, but we can't speak English. We can't do it the other way, which requires a different part of your brain, actually, to translate from English to Yiddish." So I can understand that. But so is there then, do we have two separate paths of development now? What's happening? The academic Yiddish people who are interested in reading the old-time Yiddish works, and then the people who are like, just because they're involved in that circle, people who are speaking Yiddish, Gittel?
I'm not quite sure who the women were on your show.
And I'm not going to tell you.
Quite sure. No, that's okay. But I'm quite sure that they were not Yiddish language professors. Because if you're going to teach a language, you have to know the language. And it sounds to me like perhaps they were teaching a course of Yiddish literature in translation or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
No,
it was not conversational Yiddish they were teaching. That's correct. It was more like a Yiddish literature and history of Yiddish.
So that's different. And I will tell you that there is another dictionary that came out 3 years ago, also from Indiana University Press, called the Comprehensive Yiddish-English Dictionary. It's different from ours. We know the people. We're good friends with them. But their dictionary is targeted to people who are reading the language, reading the literature, and need to know, well, what is this word that I just found in Peretz? And they look it up, and there's the English word. So that dictionary is a dictionary that those two women would be using. An English-Yiddish dictionary, which is what we wrote, is targeted for people who want to learn the language. And whether they're speaking, whether it's America, whether it's Canada, this book could even be used in foreign countries where English is not the national language, but yet a lot of people speak English. And if this dictionary has 83,000 words, they might want to use this as opposed to maybe a French Yiddish or something that's much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there is a difference. There are the people who are studying Yiddish because they want to do research or read literature, and they don't necessarily want to speak Yiddish on a daily basis or a regular basis. And then you have the other folks, which we are part of, who speak Yiddish with their children, who try to participate in as many Yiddish activities as possible, who go to Yiddish immersion programs in the summer, who really try to make Yiddish a part of their life. And that is definitely a different, or then there's certainly overlap between the two, but the goals of the two groups are different.
Okay, that's going to do it for us. Our guest today has been Gittel Schachter-Visvanath, and who is the editor of this very wonderful compendium, a comprehensive English-Yiddish dictionary available from Indiana University Press and wherever you can buy a book. It's on Amazon and all over the web and every place else where you would think to buy a Yiddish dictionary. I want to thank you so much, Gittel. Go ahead, yes.
Can I just make one more pitch?
Sure.
That the book was actually, the copyright is by the League for Yiddish, and it would be a wonderful mitzvah if people who want to buy the book bought it from the League for Yiddish.
The League for Yiddish.
Because they're the ones who actually, who actually put all the effort into it.
Wonderful.
And the funds. So if they go to leagueforyiddish.org, they'll find the dictionary there.
Okay, wonderful. That's going to do it. Well, thank you so much, and
keep
us
apprised. Thank you, Herschel. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my... Okay, that's going to do it. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Some things are better the way they used to be, like the crisp feel of a cool autumn day, the serenity of a baby sleeping, or the feeling of coming home after a long trip. Franklin Cider Mills makes cider the way cider is supposed to be. Its old-fashioned, clear, crisp taste reminds you of a cool autumn day. Located in the heart of historic Franklin Village at 14 Mile and Franklin Road, Franklin Cider Mill has been making cider the same way for over a century. Always fresh, with no additives or preservatives. You just can't buy Franklin Cider in any supermarket. Franklin Cider Mill is open from Labor Day weekend to after Thanksgiving from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Come visit Franklin Cider Mill. It's kind of like coming home.
Herschel Finman, here you're listening to The Jewish Hour. This is your last week to get Franklin Cider. They close next Sunday. Next Sunday is the absolute day. So if you want to get it for Thanksgiving, you know, Thanksgiving morning, it's the best. You know, if you're doing one of those Thanksgiving things. And people ask me, do Jews do Thanksgiving? And the answer is well, depends if they want to. Which is a good thing. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. If you want to do it, do it. So it's a very good thing. You go Thursday morning, you get the cider. We can get it for Shabbos, whatever. And it's this week. I was just informed that WLQV, which is 1500 AM, is now broadcasting at 92.7 AM. So I'm assuming that's in stereo? FM, excuse me. It's in stereo? Yes. So if you want to like hear the like upcoming song in stereo, for example, switch over to 92.7 FM. Speaking of what's next, this is we've got a Yiddish song coming up. This is Daniel Kahn, who is a klezmer musician from Detroit. And this is an ode to, he actually wrote this a couple months ago, but it took off after the death of Leonard Cohen, Rabbi Eliezer ben Avram HaKohen. It's his more famous song, Hallelujah. Let's listen.
Gewein an Nigen wie a Sod, was David hat gespielt vor Gott, nur dir wird's nicht gewein, als a Yeshua. Und mir singt a Zoi, a Fall, a Soul, Mish berech hebt a kol, der duler meilech webt a halleluja. Deine Mune is gewollen schwach, da sheva bot sich af en dach, ihr chen die lewone, dein refuhe. Und sie nehmt ein Guff, sie nehmt ein Kopf, sie schneit von deiner Haare zopp und zieht von Mäuel a Robe, Halleluja. Und Eire, ich kenn dein Stil, ich bin geschlafen auf dein Deal, ich hab kein Mal nicht gelebt mit Ersatz nur. Nur ich seh dein Schloss, ich seh dein Fall, a Herz is nicht kein Melchstrom, es ist a kalte und a kalte, ja, Halleluja. Ui, wie am Auto sag mir ois, was tut sich dort in dein Scheuss, du wusch darfst dich schämen wie a Psoe. Und gedenk, wie ich hab in dir geruht, wie die Schiene gut in unser Blut und jeder Rot im Tod, Gott ist gar nicht da und Liebe soll sein Kolm roh a Pust der Träume zerbrochen und mich holen. Sind ich kein Gewein in Mitternacht, nicht kein bald Schuwe aufgewacht, nur an Elmte Kolkeure, Halleluja. Napikeures rufst du mich, mit Shem Hawaii lästerich, nur meile, ich der ward nicht kein Gehule. Nur es brennt sich heiß in jeden Oss, von Alef Beis, gor bisen Sof, die Heilige und Kalle, Halleluja. Halleluja. So nicht kein Sach, ich mach derweile, was ich mach, ich komm do wie ein Mensch
nishkein shluya khoch aus verloren sei wie sei will ich verloren adonai und schreien will ich heim halleluja 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 halleluja.
Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mycosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mycosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. Do we have time for another song? No, we don't. So we're going to do a little monologue. We'll play a couple more commercials. Fortunately, the interview went very long, and that's all we have time for as far as music goes this week. So the portion of the week is the portion of Chayasaurus found in chapter 23 and following. In the book of Genesis, the portion starts, the vast majority of the portion, actually, which the name of the portion is, this is the life of Sarah, but in the very first verse, Sarah dies, which is a whole thing in and of itself, and it deals with the getting Isaac married. It says that Sarah lived 127 years, but it doesn't say she lived 127 years. It says she lived 100 years, 20 years, 7 years. That way, the word years is put into, injected into every place, holder. There's reasons that Rashi gives, for example, that, you know, she was as beautiful at 100 as she was at 20, and she was as free at 20 of sin as a 7-year-old, that kind of thing. Yes. We take a different angle. A person did something very good today. That's fine. So they achieved a certain level of accomplishment today. That's fine. What happens when they get to the next plateau? What happens when something like they've got a new horizon? So now they have to like kick it up a gear. And they're cruising along at this plateau level. And then they come to another jump that they have to make. So Sarah, okay, 7, 20, 100. In every plateau, every time she was doing anything, it wasn't, well, I did this yesterday. Isn't that good enough? No. We come to this next level of achievement. The Almighty tells us we got to kick it up a gear. And we're constantly kicking it up a gear. We can see this happens, first of all, on a daily basis. If a person did so much today, did X today, so tomorrow he has to do X plus 1. Doesn't have to do X squared or X to the infinity. Has to do X plus 1. But then there are times in a person's life when there is that quantum leap and they are going to have to kick it up another notch and do something that they're not expecting, that they did not themselves did not expect to do. The Almighty says, don't worry, I'm right behind you. I'm going to get you there. And we see Sarah lived 127 years. And at 127, she was as perfect as she was as a 7-year-old. I suppose the Almighty had something to do with it, but the Almighty only helps if you want the help. You have to put this first step forward. We have to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back, but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia.
MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS drug detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
I hear you listening to the Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Go to rabbifinman.com, RABBIFINMAN.com. You will find archived editions of the show. You will find archived editions of the E-Parsha, the U-Parsha, the Hasidic U-Story. You'll find classes that I've done. You'll be able to contact me. It's all there. And you'll find the very important donations page. The Jewish Hour is listener-funded, but for the most part, we do have some sponsors, and they cover some of the tab. And thank God we do have them to pick up that tab. But it's mostly by people like you who are listening in. So go to Rabbi Finman, click on it. It's PayPal, it's safe, it's secure, it's very easy. And I always have this promise that if we raise the funds for the month, then we don't talk about it anymore. But you got one more week. So if you don't want to hear me talking about this next week, go do it today. So give today. You'll be glad you did. In conjunction with this idea that we talked about before of progressing, there was a group of students that came to the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the early 1960s. They were college students from Columbia University. And they were, they got an orientation as to what to expect, what to do, what not to do. And they were told about the what we believe the Lubavitcher Rebbe was, that he was a tzaddik. He was like a perfect person. He didn't make mistakes. One of the students, when they went into the audience, there's a whole group, I don't know, maybe 20 of them, went in and they asked the Rebbe, if the Rebbe is a tzaddik, why does he need an eraser on the end of his pencil? Now, to me, that sounds like not only a nudgy question, a bit of borderline chutzpah question as well, but just like you have nothing better to ask. The Rebbe took it all in stride. This is one of those places where the answer is much better than the question. The Rebbe said that when a person writes something today, and they're writing down their thoughts, so that's good for today. Tomorrow, the Almighty has gone to sleep. They've woken up, and they're essentially a new person. So now that they look at what they did yesterday, they see that there could be something better. Not that there was anything wrong with what they did yesterday, but now on this new and improved level that that person is on, there's something better that they can do. Therefore, this, what they did yesterday, might need some touching up and might need some erasing to be done. That's going to do it for the hour. We thank you so much for tuning into the Jewish Hour here on WLQV, 1500 AM and 92.7 FM on your listening dial. Don't forget to listen to it on podcast at RabbiFinman.com. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. Take care. Shlofen alechasi.